This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Whose motorcycle is this?
It's a chopper, baby.
Whose chopper is this?
Zed's.
Who's Zed?
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
Precious. Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Go ahead. Make my day.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
Hasta la vista, baby. I'll be back.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father. I am your father.
I am Blackwell.
Say hello to my little friend!
And welcome to the Casting Couch. For another week of film interviews, reviews and discussion, my name is Thomas Caldwell and I'm joined again by Kylie Eddy.
Hello, good afternoon.
How are you, Kylie?
I'm wilting in the summer sun. I'm a bit of a delicate petal. It's not really my...
I can't say I'm a fan of the summer.
You know
either.
What? We're both pasty white people who spend a lot of time in the cinema. We're not meant to be outdoors in this kind of weather.
It somewhat comes with the territory, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, a big thanks to Lisa and Sue for taking care of the Women's Zone and also for Helen for reading the news. Panelling for us today is Maureen O'Keefe, filling in for Alan. Alan's produced the show but absent today, so thank you very much, Maureen, for taking care of all that sort of stuff for us. Now, Kylie, on the show today, we're going to be reviewing it's much anticipated by me anyway.
By some.
The new Martin Scorsese film, and this is Shutter Island, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. We're also going to be talking about a film that you went off to see called Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief.
If only the film was as exciting as the title.
Oh, don't tell us about it just yet. We've got to keep people...
Yeah. Wait for more.
Let's face it, yeah, I think we also know where that's going to head, don't we? Now, Maureen, who is panelling for us today, is also going to tell us all about the new Catherine Bigelow film, The Hurt Locker, a film that almost went straight to DVD in Australia. But when it started getting lots of awards and attention, it has got a cinema release and now a swag of Academy Award nominations. So, to the distributor, who will remain nameless, well done putting that on the big screen here. Byron's going to pop in to review a DVD called Jeffrey. This is courtesy of our buddies at Love Film. Jeffrey was a 1990s film that's finally getting its DVD debut in Australia.
It's the first time it's been available on DVD in Australia.
In this country, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty, and it is a seminal gay film.
Yep.
So I'll be very interested to see what Byron has to say.
Yeah, I unfortunately have never seen it, so I'm very curious to know what Byron thinks.
Oh, I can't
believe
it.
I can't see everything.
That's not true.
Hey, we're also going to be talking to a guy called Martin Pedler. Now, Martin is one of four panellists in an event at Acme this Thursday called Dead Set Zombie TV. They're a group of sort of fun-loving academics who are going to talk about the ideology and the politics of zombies on television. They also did a panel last year, I think, all about vampires. I looked at things like Buffy and True Blood, and it sold out. So they're very entertaining, and Martin's going to be telling us all about that, and we'll probably branch off onto all sorts of wacky topics about television and zombies.
There's so many things to talk about. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, if you want to get in touch with us throughout the show, we'd love to hear what you think. If you just want to tell us about a film you've seen recently, or you want to tell me how brilliant my music selection is, I know there's one of you, or maybe two of you, who does that. You can call us on 1-300-JOY-949, SMS on 0427-JOY-949, or email onair@joy.org.au. Now, tomorrow, Joy and Cinema Nova are doing a very special screening of A Single Man. This is the new film starring Colin Firth. It's been directed by fashion designer Tom Ford. I believe it's the first film he's ever directed. That's going to be showing at Cinema Nova tomorrow, and we've got two double passes to go. It doesn't get released till next Thursday. We'll be giving those away later in the show, so you'll just have to keep listening for more details about how that is all going to work. Okay. I'm going to be playing a stack of music today from Martin Scorsese films, since it is the new Scorsese film that's come out, Shutter Island. And we're talking about three or four decades worth of interesting music. So it's a mixture of sort of Phil Spector-produced stuff. There's some Rolling Stones, of course, and then music by composer legends like Philip Glass and Bernard Herrmann. I'll be playing them all.
Oh, you are so excited about this, Thomas.
Look at me.
You and Marty, I can tell, are just best buds. this is going to be very interesting.
Yeah, so a guy in his early 30s who adores Martin Scorsese films.
You're not a cliche. Come on.
That's not a cliche in the slightest, isn't it? But first, I'm going to be a bit indulgent. I went to a concert last night by a group called British Sea Power from Brighton. And that's Brighton, UK, by the way, not Brighton, that snooty suburb near Cheltenham, wherever it is. They're from the UK, and they just blew the roof off the venue. So I'm going to play a song of theirs now from their 2003 album. This is a track called Carrion. You're listening to Thomas and Kylie on the Casting Couch on Joy 94.9. That was... I've gone completely blank. You're listening to Joy 94.9 on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie.
At least you remember who you are and where you are.
Also, just funking out. I love that song. That's Tricky with the song Overcome. That was used in the soundtrack for Strange Days, the 1995 Catherine Bigelow film about the New Year's Eve, 1999.
Ralph Fiennes kind of tripping out.
Really
so
weird role
great.
For Ralph Fiennes. Yeah,
great. Yeah,
I think we're both fans of Strange Days.
Absolutely.
So it's directed by Catherine Bigelow. It was written by James Cameron.
Oh, who's he? I've never heard of
him.
He did his, is he an independent filmmaker, up and coming?
He's done this small film recently called Avatar.
Really?
He used to be married to Catherine Bigelow.
I know. Apparently, she taught him everything he knows.
Oh, really?
Apparently.
Well, I can't claim that, but they're two sort of action cinema heavyweights. They were married to each other. They're not anymore, and they've now both got films that are competing at the Academy Awards. It's just so sordid and kind of soap opera.
I think it's fantastic. Apparently, you know, Hollywood speak, they're both very supportive, and he'd be delighted if she won and vice versa.
And the film we're talking about is The Hurt Locker. Now, The Hurt Locker was something Mark and I did touch on last year when we caught it at MIFF, but we've sent Maureen along, who's panelling for us today, to really evaluate it properly and bring us up to speed with what it's all about. Maureen, take it away. Tell us about The Hurt Locker.
Okay, so as you said, it was directed by Catherine Bigelow, and the screenwriter is a journalist as well, Mark Bowell, who was actually embedded with a bomb unit in Iraq. So, and he's based this the characters on the people that he presumably was embedded with. So it's set in 2004, which is... So it's post-invasion Iraq, like a year later, so it's the early days of the post-invasion, and in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. And the film's focusing on a unit called the EOD. There's a few acronyms in this film.
Yeah, a lot, aren't there?
Yeah, that stands for the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit, and their job is they get sent out to go and disarm these roadside bombs, which I think are often meant to be homemade, but in the film it's apparent that they can be incredibly complicated devices. Mm. At the beginning of the film, the existing team leader is killed. So a new team leader is appointed, and this is Sergeant William James.
And the guy we see who gets killed at the start is played by Australia's own Guy Pearce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so he had a very powerful few scenes at the beginning. But the new boy, Sergeant William James, played by Jeremy Renner, I don't know, have you seen him in anything before?
No, Kylie, you were looking him up before.
I have, because his face is so familiar, and I think he's one of those great character actors. I'm thinking probably in The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford is probably his biggest kind of role.
Yeah, which I've seen, but I can't recall him in that.
He's so funny. He looks so familiar to me. It might come to me.
He looks a bit like, what's his name, Nathan Filton from Serenity and Firefly.
Yeah,
he kind
absolutely.
Of has that sort of... boy next door good looks to him.
Absolutely.
Mm. But that's the other interesting, or one of the interesting things about this film is that the three kind of main characters are all played by lesser known actors.
They're not stars, are they?
So that you've got Anthony Mackie, who plays Sergeant Sanborn, and Brian Geraghty, that plays Owen Eldridge, and they're the other two people in this unit. And so it's a really engrossing war movie, but it's sort of like very character-based as well, as you follow these three as they go out on these bomb disposal exercises. I think it's really a good film in putting you in the plate, like feeling like you're right there alongside it, like watching while James, who's the team leader, and they seem to be the ones who normally do the actual bomb defusing.
Yeah, you don't want to get a promotion in this game, do you?
But the other two guys, their job isn't so envious either. Like, you know, because they're there sort of watching, providing cover. And that's like, it's very evocative with all these, there's a lot of bystanders around, you know, like on balconies or in doorways. And so there's that whole tension about whether they are just bystanders or they're, actually part of the group that planted the bomb.
Because this was from the early days of the conflict where things were a bit mad and crazy and no one really knew who was on whose side and what was going on.
Yeah, that's right. So it's really good at that. I mean, you know, that's having that sense of foreboding and this heightened tension, but also the kind of, in a dramatic way, the tedium of it as you're waiting for while he goes through, trying to dismantle these devices. So, I mean, those scenes are really, really powerful. And there's one later in the film where it's also like a very moving, because it sort of highlights the human cost in a very moving way when there's a Iraqi man with bombs strapped to his body.
Yes, he's been forced to do that. And that's an incredible scene. Mm. I also remember being very impressed with there's a sniper scene where they're trying to target and clean a gun and fire it.
That's right. Yeah, out in the that's where Ralph Fiennes makes an appearance.
He pops up. Yeah, yeah.
Another big
Catherine
big name.
Bigelow giving him a sort of along and be our sniper expert. You can be in about 10 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
And I just had no idea firing a gun it could be so complicated.
That's right. And in a way, some of this film sort of show that it's not very high tech in some ways either. They're essentially like just lying on the ground using. I mean, I'm probably showing my naivety
and shooting a kilometre away.
Well, yeah,
but as you said at the start of your review, I mean, this is all based on journalist observation. Mm. So I think what we are seeing and what this film is educating us about is how intense it is and how difficult it is.
I heard an interview with the writer actually, and this is his first feature film credit.
Yep.
And he said that a lot of the people that he spoke with when he was actually over there felt, you know, the army guys felt like there wasn't any real depiction of how sniper actually works, because in films you want to see the two main characters battle it out kind of close to each other, and of course in a sniper attack it's not like that. It's a kilometre away. Mm. And so actually trying to capture that on film, and he was very specific about how he was he's not interested in exposition, he wasn't interested in the who's and how's, it was literally what's happening now.
Now that's interesting, because that shows, and I'm curious to know what you think, Maureen, about the fact that there is a lack of, I guess,
plot.
Flow and plot. It's a very segmented film.
Yes. I actually thought that when they weren't disposing the bombs, I actually felt like the film lagged a little bit. Mm-hmm. And some of the plot devices one in particular seemed a bit ludicrous, where in the middle of a Baghdadi night, the three protagonists went down three different alleys. Like, I just thought that was seemed to be the thing that you really wouldn't do when you'd seen how they behave, you know, during the day.
I know exactly what you mean. I think there is something about the narrative of this film that is a bit flawed, because a lot of people have been rushing to embrace it and it's had a lot of acclaim, and I like it. But I'm not 100% sure it is that great a film. I don't think it's Catherine Bigelow's best film. I think she's done far better films than this one. Like Strange Days for one, Near Dark, an early vampire film she did. I even quite like, is it K-19, The Widowmaker?
Yeah.
Submarine film.
But which apparently wasn't very well received.
No,
and
it was
so
a flop.
That's partly why there's been a time gap of 7 years before she's made another one.
Blue Steel, Jamie Lee Curtis. Great cop character there.
And Point Break.
Well,
who can forget Point Break? That's really interesting, because I think part of what both Catherine and the writer and why they connect is that it's about vignettes. It's about being present. It's about not glorifying the details, but and also not taking sides, about being really this is how it is.
Mm.
And sometimes that can lead to maybe not as much plot as traditionally in these kind of films.
Maureen, what are you going to give this out of five?
Look, just because of the action scenes, I will still give it a four.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. Yep, I got a high 3.5 for me. So maybe a 3.75. All right, now, I'm going to start my Scorsese retrospective now. I'm going to start off with a song that's used in the film Mean Streets. Now, this song is Be My Baby by the Ronettes. Now, I know there's lots of people thinking, hang on, wasn't that the song at the start of Dirty Dancing? It was, but Scorsese got to it first, and I don't own the Dirty Dancing soundtrack. I've got a Best of Phil Spector's produced songs.
Excuse me, do own the Dirty Dancing soundtrack.
Okay.
And I can appreciate it for that.
Okay, so take what you will from this song, Dirty Dancing or Mean Streets. It's a gorgeous song. The Ronettes with Be My Baby here on Joy 94.9. You're back on the casting couch with Thomas and Kylie, and now we've been joined by our good buddy Byron.
Hello.
G'day, Byron. How are you?
Good. Nice, bit warm outside.
It is, isn't it?
It is.
Always good to have you in the studio with us. Now, you're reviewing Jeffrey. This is a 1995 film. It's finally getting an Australian DVD release.
Yes, indeed. And I must admit, it was really good to actually sit down and watch this film, because over the last probably 10, 15 years, this is a film where I just always seem to change the channel and catch... I've missed half of it already.
Okay.
So this was the first time I was actually able to sit down and watch it all the way through. Now, the idea with Jeffrey is Jeffrey has decided that sex is all just a bit too much.
Yeah, we've all been there.
And so he decides to embark on a celibate lifestyle. But just as he's sort of starting off on that, things sort of come his way, which make him question that. But it's quite a powerful film in another respect as well. Like, I think I'm going back from what I remember in the early 1990s, there was... people were dying from AIDS, whereas I suppose now we have people with HIV that are living full lives. And so at one point, Jeffrey sort of put off this guy that he meets, Steve, because Steve admits that he's HIV positive.
Oh, wow, okay.
And, yeah, I just remember watching the film and thinking, yeah, I do remember a time like that where people were scared to say something. They probably still are, but where they were scared to say anything. And there were people that would just, no, sorry, don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah, so 15 years ago, it was just far more taboo than it is now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but no, it's a really good film. We've got Michael T. Weiss plays Steve in this film. Michael T. Weiss,
he's the lead. Steve's the lead.
No, Jeffrey's the lead.
Jeffrey's the lead. That's why the film's not called Jeffrey Thomas.
Yeah, I can't recall, actually. The guy that
Steve
plays...
Rather.
Yes.
God, continue. I'll shut up.
I can't recall seeing the guy that plays Jeffrey in anything else before, mm-hmm. but the guy that plays Steve, Michael T. Weiss, however you want to say it,
yeah.
People would remember him from the sort of semi-sci-fi series The Pretender.
I love The Pretender.
Yeah,
I absolutely love The Pretender. And I think, you know, also at this time, it's quite amazing to get straight actors playing gay. It wasn't like you were going to win an Oscar in 1995 for being gay for pay. Mm. So it is actually a really brave decision for these actors to play these roles.
Yeah, and the thing that I've always loved, when I have caught this film sort of channel surfing, the thing that I've always loved is Patrick Stewart plays Sterling, an oh-so camp interior designer. And I can just remember the first time I saw it, I'm like, wow, that's not how I pictured Captain Jean-Luc Picard. But yeah, no, and even at one point, like, someone says something and Sterling just turns around and goes, get her. And I'm just like, all my sort of manly Captain Jean-Luc Picard images are just shattered in one go. But no, I think Patrick Stewart really does. It's sort of a side sort of backup role in this film, but he does a brilliant job in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's some interesting cameos, I suppose you could call them, as well. We've got Christine Baranski in there, Kathy Najimy, and Sigourney Weaver have all got parts in this film.
Oh, Sigourney Weaver in there.
Yeah, she's a motivational speaker.
I love Sigourney Weaver.
But yeah, no, I really enjoyed this film, and I'm going to give it probably a 4. What can I give it? 4 Pride, New York Pride parades out of 5.
Oh, 4, sensational.
Because it's actually... I can't remember if I'm... Did the film footage that you see of Pride Parade, is that actual New York Pride Parade footage?
I think that probably is.
I think it was, yeah.
Because I think that would be, because I mean, this is obviously a low budget film, and I think at that time it would have been very hard to reconstruct that.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably, you know, that footage from the actual time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it is.
A low budget film like that wouldn't have put on their own parade.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So that's really interesting because I haven't seen it, and my big worry is it would have dated. But it sounds like you're saying, one, it's a very interesting sign of the times.
But secondly,
it's still a good film.
It's still a good film. It is. You can tell that it's the early 90s, like what they're wearing, all that sort of stuff. Like, it's very much Jeffrey's walking around in the tight blue jeans and the American baseball zip-up jacket thingy.
A Letterman jacket?
Not like, you know, the
those bomber jackets.
With the A on it.
And hasn't his love interest got, like, a leather jacket and white T-shirt?
Yeah.
Yeah. The 90s, they were a high point of fashion.
They were.
Folks, here's something I'm surprised about. Jeffrey was 1995. I just looked up Philadelphia, of course, the Tom Hanks film and Antonio Banderas film. That was 93.
Yeah.
Now, I would have thought something like Philadelphia came a lot later, but apparently it was fairly early. And yet we still talk about Jeffrey as quite an iconic, important film in gay cinema. Do you think it's because perhaps Jeffrey was very much from a GLBTI point of view, where Philadelphia was a toned-down story for a bigger audience?
Possibly. And I actually think the whole, as I was saying, the whole taboo and the whole sort of analysing of Jeffrey sort of shying away from Steve because Steve's confessed that he's HIV positive, I think that was that's the real ingrained message of this film, trying to break down that whole sort of, the word I'm looking for, the whole aversion.
Aversion, yeah, sure. Okay.
I mean, and it is really from a perspective of a gay man on the looking for love and his experience, whereas I think something like Philadelphia is a lot more kind of broader, worthier, and kind of really about how do we make AIDS palatable to a mainstream audience, and we'll get good old Tommy Hanks to play the victim. So, you know, it's from a completely different perspective.
That's interesting. So Philadelphia was your issue film. Jeffrey was, this is how people live. This is a real depiction of this society.
Well, I don't know about real. There is some flashback sequences and some dream sequences from what I remember. Like, it is a comedy. Yep.
Yeah, it's got elements of that whole the pilot episode of Sex and the City, where you saw Sarah Jessica Parker actually standing there and looking at the camera and talking about things. You see Jeffrey doing the same sort of things. It's like, and his thoughts, he'll actually be speaking his thoughts, and then the scene around him starts interacting with his thoughts.
So it's kind of wacky.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, Byron. So 4 stars from Byron. Yes. Jeffrey, it's available from any retailers that are GLBTI friendly and stock the appropriate DVDs. Jeffrey from Love Films. Okay, more music now. We're going to stay with the Scorsese theme. I'm going to play another Phil Spector produced song. This is from the film Goodfellas. It's by The Crystals. The name of the song is He's Sure the Boy I Love. I thought that was appropriate. You're listening to Thomas and Kylie on the Casting Couch. Joy 94.9.
Come along.
And you're back on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie. Now, Kylie, we were just talking about the DVD Jeffrey, and we were talking about the difference in perception and attitude towards being HIV positive.
Now and then, though, we've just had someone who's SMS'd in saying about our comments that it still very much happens. He was online earlier and all was going well until he mentioned to the guy that he was HIV positive. So there is still stigma attached. I mean, I think we would all like to think that we've come a long way. I guess the same thing is with same-sex partnerships and so on and so forth, you know, that we feel accepted by the community, and yet there seems to be some barriers around these kind of issues. I mean, I think in a film and TV kind of land, Queer as Folk for me was a seminal TV series where there was a HIV positive character and really had time to delve into the character, which was much more than that, obviously. And you know, I guess that's really about the only place that I can think of on TV where that has really been explored like that. I'm sure if people know of other things, they'll please SMS and let us know.
But on to the next film we're going to review today. Shutter Island.
You have been so excited about this.
Yeah, well, I think I should put a disclaimer out there. I'm a massive Martin Scorsese fan. Haven't been so much of a fan of his recently, but I've been very excited about this film. Now, for years, of course, Martin Scorsese always used to cast Robert De Niro as his on-screen alter ego, and since Gangs of New York, which is possibly his worst film, he's been using Leonardo DiCaprio, and DiCaprio is again once starring in Scorsese's latest film, Shutter Island.
I mean, it's set in 1954, and it's about a U.S. Marshal, Teddy Daniels, who's played by Leonardo DiCaprio. He's investigating the disappearance of a murderess who's escaped from a hospital for the criminally insane.
So she's a crazy murderess as well.
Oh, are there any other kind?
She's criminally insane as opposed to just being a bad person.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm. Well, that makes her much worse. And it's located on the remote Shutter Island.
Yeah. And that's kind of all we should really say about the story, because it develops in a very, very particular way. And I reckon that the less you know about this film, the better.
It is twisty, twisty.
It is very twisty. However, I think you can tell very much from the word go there is something very strange going on. And it's mainly because of DiCaprio's character is very weird.
Do you think it's not also about that music, which is a little bit like the Jaws soundtrack gone crazy wrong?
The music's really quite intense in this film, and I am convinced that on many levels, Scorsese has been hugely influenced by The Shining.
Because
The Shining...
I can't believe you said that's exactly how I felt.
I don't think we're the only ones who have seen it and have come up to that conclusion, but just the way he shoots the prison and the way something quite normal becomes incredibly creepy when the music goes berserk is very The Shining. I mean, I'll go as far to say, you know, this is Scorsese. The prison is like the Overlook Hotel. It's his labyrinthine space that drives people mad and ensnares them.
And I think also as well, it's not just the music, it's the tone, and it's also the visual depiction of, at times, incredibly disturbing imagery, yet it is displaced. It's from a distance. It is to keep you intellectually horrified, yet at the same time, continue viewing.
It's a lovely way to
put it. Well, it's a different kind of experience than watching, say, your slasher type of film or your serial killer kind of film or any of those kind of things that obviously this kind of genre makes you know, think of.
Yeah, it's a pulpy film. Well, it looks it's not. No, let me rephrase that. It looks like it's a pulpy film, but it really is not. It's playing by its own set of rules. And I think this is the kind of film where almost talking about the storyline is redundant. I think it works on a slightly higher level than that. It is really trying to engage the audience to outsmart it. And I know there are several times when I was watching this film, I was scribbling notes. I thought I'd found flaws and things that were down badly. And I was thinking, what a shame. And afterwards...
Marty's lost it.
Marty,
I'm never going to call him again.
Yeah, he's a bit slack there. I'm riding my bike home and suddenly it just all started falling into place. And I thought, no, damn it, this film did outsmart me. I thought I was cleverer and that's the trick.
I don't know whether so much that's a trick or whether I care or not. At some point, I know it's twisty-twisty, and at some point I go, you know, I'm not sure that I care. And part of this for me, and I think we're talking about similar things, it's about the tone of this film. I feel like this film has genre dyslexia. It is, and I think a big part of that is the way it's being marketed. I understand that people who do marketing for films, they want as many people as possible to go see a film.
We talked about this with The Road, how it was really badly represented.
Does feel like a psychological thriller. Mm. Is this a drama? Is this a psychological thriller? Or is this really just a gussied up, self-important horror film? You know, it really, I think...
I don't think it's any of those things.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm asking the question, Thomas.
I think this is the work of a cinema master who's playing cat and mouse with the audience. I think this is Scorsese having a great time taking what looks like a genre film and really messing with it.
Well, I think if you go along...
See, for me...
For fun...
Yep.
I think you're probably going to enjoy certain elements of this. If you're looking for worthiness or Scorsese, then I don't think this is the film.
Now you see, I think this is an interesting continuation of Scorsese's themes. He loves having this kind of melancholic male protagonist who's deeply flawed, and Leonardo DiCaprio's character is that in spades.
Yeah.
And Scorsese loves his subjectivity. You know, he did it in Kundun and Last Temptation of Christ and Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. He's taken that kind of subjective camera to the extreme in this film to really mess with perception, but also on a level that actually messes with cinematic style and narrative conventions.
I mean, those are actually some of the parts that I enjoyed the most.
Yeah.
There are some visual elements in this film that are so incredibly captivating and moving, and it's literally like something you've never seen before. Mm-hmm. There are moments in this film where you just go, my mind is just blown. Now, part of me goes, like, as a person watching a film, part of me goes, well, that actually takes me out of the film because I'm looking at it from a stylistic, like, I'm going, look, how does he do, look at that, what's, oh, that looks beautiful. Mm. But it does really take me out of the story quite often because it's distractingly beautiful at some point.
I do know what you mean. I really do know what you mean. You know, I think I had a very unusual response to this film in the sense that it's, to the extent that I loved it and enjoyed it, happened half an hour after seeing it. During the film, I was really in two minds about what to think. And it was afterwards, it just hit me like a freight train. Yeah. And I just thought, hang on, I've got to see this film again. It is amazing.
Can I just say about seeing this film again? Okay, now I was a bad film reviewer. I actually saw this on Thursday when it came out. And foolishly, I was getting a latte and I missed the first 5 minutes of the film. So for the whole time, I'm like, I've really missed something. So there was this questioning, and I hate missing the first 5 minutes of any film.
I usually won't walk in.
Exactly. I really do. Like if I miss the opening shot, something in my brain just clicks and I can't stand it. And I'm like this. So all through the film, already it's messing with your head, and then I've got that added level.
I missed the start.
I know. So I actually went out when the film finished. I went outside, and you know, it's a Thursday during the day. And I said to the guy, I said, at the ticket box office, I said, look, this is going to sound really weird, but I just missed the beginning of the film. I think I've gone crazy. Can I please? When's the next session? Can I just see the first 5 minutes of the next session? Mm-hmm. So I did go in, and of course, you know, it does set up the film. Yeah. But of course, I was already seeing it from a different perspective. And you know what? I think that you would have a different understanding of the film. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'd want to see it again, though, because some of those images are so horrifying that I just don't want them in my head any more than they are.
Sure, that's a fair play. I think that's the difference between you and me, because I can't wait. I've been trying to find a spare 2.5 hours to see this again. I cannot wait to go back. All right, let's rate it. Who's going to put themselves on the line first? Shall I put myself on the line?
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty obvious your score's going to be.
This is the first 2010 film that I think is a significant event. I mean, there's a lot of good films released so far from 2009 this year, but this is the first 2010 film that I think is really worth getting excited about. I'm giving it 4.5 stars.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Don't make me cry.
Well, look, there are elements that I really liked.
Yeah.
There were things, though, that I felt like I was being exploited. Mm-hmm. Like, I did feel it was a little exploitative and a little bit. There were, like, you know, by the end, I'm like, you know what? I get it. And I just really don't want to see that again.
Sure.
So I'm giving it a 3.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, a 3.
I thought from how we were talking, you would have rated it higher.
No, well, look, Leonardo is amazing.
Yeah.
The supporting actors are incredible. Yep. We haven't even mentioned how fantastic, you know, Mark Ruffalo.
I heart Mark Ruffalo in every regard.
And Michelle Williams is absolutely, I think it's the best role I have ever seen her in. She is fantastic.
Yeah, she just keeps getting better. Hasn't she taken us all by surprise how good she is?
She is absolutely. Yeah. This role is pivotal to the film, even though it's a small part.
Yeah.
And I'm just getting chills thinking about her performance. And of course, when you're Marty, you can just get the sublime Patricia Clarkson to come in for a cameo role.
Yeah.
So all of those supporting actors and the visual style make me get over some of the elements that I didn't quite enjoy.
All right, good. Oh, we've had a good rigorous discussion here. You're listening to Thomas and Kylie here on The Casting Couch. Now, I am playing all music from Scorsese films, so I've picked one track from Shutter Island. Kylie, I'm hoping it's not one of the really jarring, discordant ones.
It's not going to make me have flashbacks or something.
Yeah. He actually uses the same composer that Kubrick used for 2001
The Shining. Well, there's so many
Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to pick a piece of music which is a sort of mashup. Oh, where's my cheat sheet? A mashup of an instrumental piece called On the Nature of Daylight by Max Richter, who scored Waltz with Bashir, and a song by Diana Washington, a 1960 song called This Bitter Earth. So this is This Bitter Earth versus, if you like, On the Nature of Daylight from Shutter Island. News is coming up next. You're listening to The Casting Couch. This is Joy 94.9. We're back on The Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie. Just before those announcements, we heard some Peter Gabriel music from The Last Temptation of Christ, probably Martin Scorsese's most controversial film.
Apart from Shutter Island.
No. Well, apart from now, now Shutter Island's the most controversial. But I don't think there will be sort of radical right-wing Christians protesting Shutter Island outside the cinemas and demanding it get shut down. Although the Catholics were the ones who went nuts over The Last Temptation of Christ. Yeah. Who would have seen that happen, eh? Hey, let's talk about a slightly less worthy film. I mean, I haven't seen it. I shouldn't make judgments about films
I haven't
seen.
No one's going to be. Well, people could be protesting to take it out of cinemas, but for completely different reasons.
The title is Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief. And this title makes me think we're at the start of a series.
Can anyone say trilogy?
Yeah. Is it a trilogy or is it an ongoing?
Well, I think it's based on a series of books. There are five in the series. And I haven't read the books. I'm sure they're fantastic. They're in the teen genre. Harry Potter, a little bit older, perhaps.
Yeah. So teen or tween?
No, I think teen.
More teen, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this film is a contemporary fantasy film that centres around Percy Jackson, a modern-day teenager who discovers he's a demigod. Handy. And with his friends, embarks on a journey to save the world from destruction and battling Greek gods.
When I was a teenager, I used to long for that, to discover I was actually a god and I can call the shots.
Yeah, this kid doesn't seem so impressed by it.
I still think about that. I can't wait to be world dictator and just call the shots.
You're going to be Zeus.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic.
Exactly. When Woody Allen was asked, are you nepotistic, he said, the character from Greek mythology that I would not identify myself with is Neptus. It would be Zeus.
Yeah, well, you're in the same boat, obviously.
Sorry, I'm being silly.
You're taking over my incredibly important movie review. I've never done that to anyone else before. But my biggest feeling with this film is, can anyone say exposition? There is so much exposition in this film because basically it's setting up a whole new world. Not that the world is that complicated, people. We do not need an hour explaining how, you know, so his father, who's Poseidon, who's the god of sea and monsters, came down and had an affair with a human woman who's played by, you know, this poor Catherine Kerner. I have never seen her so...
Catherine Kerner.
Well, being John Malkovich is really, I guess...
Oh, Catherine Kerner. She's sensational.
Amazing.
40-year-old virgin.
Amazing. And she is really looks put upon in this film. Mm-hmm. Oh, I just felt so bad for her. And he finds out, you know, that he's this demigod and they've been, you know, and he's... family have been protecting him all these years, and of course, being the teenager that it is, he's completely ungrateful. And he goes off on this quest. The only problem is, this quest is really boring. Mm. So the film feels like, to me, it doesn't really get going until a minute. I wish it was a minute. An hour 30 into it. I'm like, this is exciting. There's finally a set piece. Oh, then, sorry, the film's finished now.
And it's 118 minutes as well. So that's,
yeah, so it wasn't quite finished.
But what you're getting at is it felt long.
It was a long 2 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, my advice is go see the trailer and save yourself an hour and 58 minutes.
It's a good trailer, hey?
Well, the trailer is excellent and it does show the exciting bits of the film.
That's just one of the most damning reviews ever. See the trailer.
It's better than the film. There's less exposition. I get it. Yeah. Like, and I mean, look, and also, look, people who want to go and see this movie, please close your ears now or don't watch the trailer, because it gives away who the nemesis is and who the lightning thief is. So all the way through this whole hour and 40 minutes up until kind of the crisis point,
this film just keeps getting longer.
You're going, who could it be? Who could be the lightning thief? But because you've seen the trailer, you know who it is. So it's not really a shock when it's finally revealed in the film.
Now, it's directed by Chris Columbus, who I don't think is a particularly esteemed director. He may have done some interesting things early. But, some of his recent films included the first two Harry Potters.
Yeah. And
now, I enjoyed the first one because that was my introduction to Harry Potter. But the second one was a very bland rehash. And otherwise, he's been guilty of films such as Bicentennial Man, Stepmum, 9 Months, Mrs. Doubtfire, He did the first two Home Alone films, and he did Adventures in Babysitting, so props to him for those. Adventures in Babysitting is a great film.
Gee, but, I'm sure he would love to hear that.
Are there any scenes where characters start dancing to Motown music and pretending to sing into their hairbrushes?
There are a few dancing scenes, actually.
Because he loves that. He loves spontaneous dancing scenes between wacky friends and family.
Yeah, there is a little bit of dancing.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it was fun. But not really. I mean, look, this feels to me like Hollywood is desperate to find a replacement for Harry Potter.
That's what people are saying, yeah.
And it does feel like that, unfortunately. Now, look, I'm not also a Harry Potter fan, so maybe I'm not the best person to go and see this film. But it just doesn't seem to have any of the heart, like the actual thing that makes... And also, this kid, this Percy Jackson, he is so annoying. And just, I don't know, he's just bland and he's also kind of cool, which I don't really care about the cool kid.
Yeah, that's interesting because I get annoyed too about these characters who are too cool and popular. I can't feel for them. I even have trouble with Harry Potter to an extent because he's blessed with all this wonderful magical stuff. And he's just naturally brilliant at things. So I like my underdogs, to be honest. I like people who are suffering who...
Well, this guy, this kid literally doesn't go on much of a journey. He finds out he's a demigod.
Mm.
You think that's a pretty interesting kind of thing that you can find out, but really he doesn't really do anything with it. Now, there is a huge, they've thrown every A-list actor that they could possibly pay enough to be in this film.
I'm just looking at the cast, and it looks like a brilliant cast.
Do
any of them have a moment to shine or...
Well, Pierce Brosnan, I think this is maybe his worst outing since the
Mamma Mia.
Since the singing of Mamma Mia. Oh. This time he's one of those, he's like the guy who's half horse.
Centaur,
thank you.
The horsey guy.
And, you know, really, it's embarrassing. But you know who does, like the few minutes that I enjoyed were when they finally got to the underworld. And Hades is played by Steve Coogan, who's hilarious. And Rosario Dawson he's trapped. Persephone.
My parents have a cat named Persephone, so I know that.
Good.
We call her Seffy for short.
Brilliant. Well, they both steal their 10 minutes. You know, they are both fantastic and really hammered up. And by that time, you're so desperate for entertainment. There is also a brief Uma Thurman moment.
Yeah,
She's also excellent for that 5 minutes.
She plays Medusa.
I know, and she's fantastic.
Snake hair woman.
Yeah, and great. Oh, look, there's so much that you want to like in this film.
So is this a film where if you've got a really good and patient editor who just sort of cut it down to a 5-minute YouTube clip, you might enjoy it?
Go see the trailer.
And I noticed we've got Sean Bean there as Zeus. Oh, I'm not buying that for a second.
Neither am I. And I've got to say as well that, you know, Percy's dad is played by Kevin McKidd, who's actually in Grey's Anatomy. He's like the trauma surgeon in Grey's Anatomy, redhead. And he's actually quite a fine actor.
Hmm.
But these two, Sean and Kevin, seriously, it's hard not to laugh.
Wasted. On a final note, the kid playing Percy, his next role will be the new Spider-Man. Isn't that depressing?
Oh, no. Come on, that's terrible.
Stay with me. What are you going to give this out of five? Percy Jackson and the Olympians.
That destroyed me. He's so bad. Anyway, okay, so I'm going to give this... Half a point out of five.
Damn.
And that's really for Rosario.
For Rosario. And Uma. Half a star out of five from Kylie.
It's my first worst movie of the year.
Yeah, look, you're not alone. A lot of people are saying the same thing.
I feel like I've taken one for the team, people.
Yeah, well, I saw The Wolfman last week, so that's true. Even.
Okay, good.
All right, some more music. Let's stick with the Scorsese theme. We have no choice. That's what I've brought in. This is a track from Goodfellas, Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones, here on the Casting Couch, Joy 94.9. Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones here on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie. Joy 94.9. You like that one, Kylie?
Love it.
Excellent. Hey, we are doing a giveaway now for A Single Man. Here are the details. Tomorrow, Sunday, 21st of February at 6:30 p.m. at Cinema Nova. Be the first to see this amazing film directed by fashion designer Tom Ford, starring Colin Firth and Juliana Moore. Firth plays a closeted gay man struggling with the death of his partner. So join Joy at this preview screening this Sunday, 21st of Feb at Cinema Nova, Lygon Street, Carlton. Thanks to Cinema Nova for putting this all together, and thank you for giving us two double passes to give away on the show.
This film is amazing. It is worth seeing. We're going to review it next week.
We have both already seen it.
And it does sound maybe a little bit bleak from that description, but I almost feel like it's a life-changing film. I don't want to put too big a props on it, but it really affected me. I loved it.
We'll talk more next week, but I would urge people to see it.
Please go and see it.
Okay, here's the deal. You've got until 6:45 to get in touch. So what's the time now? 6:24. So that's, what, about 20 minutes. I'm doing maths here.
Maths on the fly.
I'm a film reviewer. I can't do maths. you've got 20 minutes to get in touch. You can SMS us on 0427-JOY-949. Warren's at the desk, ready to take your call. You can call him on 1300-JOY-949 or email onair@joy.org.au. You do, of course, have to be a Joy member or willing to join up on the spot, and you can't have won something from Joy over the last 2 weeks. Okay, so get on to that.
You have to be available to go to the screening tomorrow.
Yeah, it's tomorrow at 6:30. We'll just say that once more. And hey, even if you don't win, go along and see it anyway. It should be a really, really fun night. Okay, a little bit more music now. A song from The Departed. This is the Dropkick Murphys with I'm Shipping Up to Boston.
Hello, this is Julia Zemira from Rockwiz, and you're on the casting couch here on Joy, 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 Joy. I do mind sound effects.
Indeed, you're back with Thomas and Kylie here on the casting couch. Now, sometime late last year, a panel at Acme got together to talk about vampires in popular culture and specifically on television. The gang are back to talk about zombies. They're going to cover shows such as Joss Whedon's Dollhouse, Dead Like Me, and Pushing Daisies. Now, we are joined by one quarter of the team, Martin Pedler.
Hello, nice to be here.
Thank you very much, Martin. Now, Martin, you're an academic at Melbourne Uni on your way to your PhD.
On my way is a nice way to put it.
How long have you been on your way?
A few years, and I'd think this to be the last question along this road.
All right, let's talk about some of your other credentials, because you're a film critic as well with JMag, amongst other outlets. You're a scriptwriter. Mm-hmm. Your first film is just wrapped up. What do you call it when you film it?
I'm a writer, I know no such terms. I believe it's shooting. Yes. Yes.
Thank you, Kylie. Yeah, you can see it's been a while since I made dodgy student films. I can't remember any of the jargon. And, of course, you're a zombie expert.
Apparently so. Now, I will be talking about some of those shows you mentioned, which is the broader interpretation of zombies, including various kinds of undead and dollhouses, Joss Whedon's dollhouses, kind of brainwashed new age sex bots, who I'm happily including as zombies as well.
Yeah.
But we will also be covering the classic Romero-style zombies. The panel is named after Charlie Brooker's British miniseries recently, Dead Set.
Yep, so the event is called Dead Set Zombie TV.
I love Dead Set because I just thought the concept of having the only people who are not zombies living in the Big Brother house is, like, it's so ironic and just beautifully played.
It is. Sadly, I think once the premise had kind of worn out its welcome, it didn't really have too much else new to say. But the great moment where a bloody survivor of the zombie apocalypse stumbles into the Big Brother house and the slack-jawed Big Brother contestants are just like, oh, look, it's a new surprise intruder, is a beautiful moment of television.
So tell us what this event's actually going to... What is it going to be? Is it a lecture? Is it a panel? Is it a sort of... You're going to show lots of clips and comment on them. People going along to this, what are they up for?
It's quite informal. I wouldn't want people to think it was a lecture. So we have four speakers. There is a Q&A at the end. But to give you an idea of the tone, for our vampire panel, Professor Angela Nadalianis from the University of Melbourne decided she was tired of vampires getting all of the love when it came to erotica, so she had written some of her own zombie erotica, which she proceeded to do a reading of, Jesus, including sound effects.
Jesus Christ. And Angela, of course, was a former lecturer of mine and yours as well.
Indeed. So. It was a disturbing moment for all of us.
Wow. Okay, is she going to be performing any of that zombie erotica at this event? Do you know? Can you tell us?
I have not heard. It was, despite the fact we were talking about the pop culture history of vampires, we all, to some degree, ended up discussing zombies as we did so. Zombies being the kind of the yang to the vampire's yin when it comes to the undead.
Well, it's an interesting thing to compare because they're both a classic undead bodies, aren't they? Except they have a different situation in popular culture. Mm. And since we are slightly academic here, I'm going to finish that statement by saying, discuss.
Well, I think the vampire body is perfect. They don't breathe. They don't
very
age.
Sexy.
They often apparently have their shirts off and sparkle in the sun. Whereas the zombie body is the complete opposite. It's mm-hmm. it's always eating, always excreting, or literally being held together as best you can as your intestines are spilling all over the road in front of you. Mm-hmm. So they're very interesting to compare.
Yeah, sure. So you are focusing on television zombies.
I think the premise for these Acme Talks is Live in the Studio based around TV. Mm-hmm. But considering the last one was meant to be about True Blood and ended up in quite a spirited discussion of whether vampires should be able to sparkle or not.
It was bound to happen, wasn't
the
it?
Big questions.
Yeah. More shocking is I came down on the side of it's okay to sparkle, people.
You what?
I know.
Oh, you're one of our peeps.
Look, I'm in no way defending the politics of the Twilight films.
Yeah.
However, as far as one of the things I like about genre movies, and I love that things like Twilight have brought genre right back up into the public consciousness, is the variations that come when you tell these stories over and over again. And vampires don't go out in the sun because it makes them sparkle is so crazy, you have to appreciate it.
So you're talking about this thing in popular culture where these iconic monsters, they get reinvented each time. Mm. And I remember reading an article recently about how part of the vampire film now is to laugh about previous expectations or myths. Like, there's always seemed to be one scene where they say, allergic to garlic? Oh, that's just from the films. We're not really.
Absolutely.
Do you find that with zombies as well?
Yes. In fact, I just witnessed a rather appalling example of this. Now, I'm in no way bagging the godfather of zombie films, George Romero, who's made some amazing films, and his original Dawn of the Dead is a zombie masterpiece.
Yeah.
Have you seen Diary of the Dead, his most recent film?
I have seen that.
It made me wish I was dead, which I don't think was the...
I was at the Percy Jackson screening, so I wished I was dead as well. I couldn't make that one.
There is actually a scene in it where he tries to work in a kind of bit of Scream-esque cultural commentary where he's like, someone's making a monster film and the character's like, no, zombies are slow, they're not fast. And it was like watching your sad old uncle do a novelty rap song at Christmas. Like, it was heartbreaking to see him attempt that meta commentary.
You see, I thought that was a comment on the Dawn of the Dead remake where they were fast and 28 Days Later. Mm. Which is a zombie film in all intents and purposes, except for the fact they aren't technically zombies.
I'm happy to spread the zombie category pretty wide, mm-hmm. I think. And I certainly think it's kind of ridiculous to look at something like 28 Days Later and not call it a zombie film just because they have a rage virus. I just made finger quotes for the people listening at home.
I'm really intrigued about how this category and how broad it can be, and I'd love to hear your ideas about Dollhouse, because I'm a huge fan of Dollhouse. It's one of my favourite series. I think, you know, obviously Joss Whedon is a master of these kind of genres, and it's intriguing that you've included in a zombie talk.
The moments, for the people who don't know the premise, it's set now but with a futuristic bent about a kind of hyper-futuristic brothel where they can wipe people's personalities and then reload them with new personalities.
But not just for sex. Come on, they also have to go on adventures.
Yes, sexy adventures.
Correct.
But in their blank state, when they're not loaded with a personality, they're like these hilarious kind of new age zombies who just wander around in yoga clothes and do finger painting. And it's much more terrifying than any normal undead revenant ever could be.
Oh, I haven't yet to see it and I'm dying to see it. Martin, can you hang around? Because we want to keep talking. We're going to play some music and we've got just a few announcements to make. You're also doing an event next month on murderers on television.
Yes, lovable murderers.
Lovable murderers. So I want to get into that as well. We're talking to Martin Pedler, who is one of the panellists on Dead Set Zombie TV. You're with Thomas and Kylie here on the Casting Couch Joy 94.9. Some more music, again from a Scorsese film. This is Roxy Music with Love is the Drug from Casino. You're back on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie, and we're speaking with Martin Pedler, who is one of the panellists on Dead Set Zombie TV, which is an event occurring at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image this Thursday. Are there tickets still left, Martin?
I believe there are still. It's very nearly sold out.
It's about done, because yes. And your Buffy vampire one sold out.
It did, yes.
Didn't it? Yeah. So people, come on, what are you waiting for? Jump on to acme.net.au and get on to that. I've also put up a link to the event on the Casting Couch Facebook page. Now, Martin, in a month's time, you're going to be flying solo talking about lovable TV murderers.
Indeed, I can finally ditch the dead weight of my fellow panellists.
They might all be zombies by then. There might be some rage virus that's taken over the university campuses.
If they hear that I've said that, there may be a rage virus, yes. Well, we were thinking about, you know, the great thing about zombies is that you don't have to feel bad when you kill them. You know, they just keep coming.
And there's a lot of pleasure in the headshot, the double tap.
Absolutely. Yeah. The recent Zombieland film even awards a zombie kill of the week, like on-screen logo, to the most imaginative zombie kill. But it got us to thinking about, you know, Dexter Morgan from the TV show Dexter on Showtime and these kind of lovable murderers, these characters who we're happy to follow every week and treat as TV heartthrobs, who are serial killers, murderers, gangsters, and so on. And why is it acceptable to murder when other crimes maybe wouldn't be? You know, Midsummer Murders is considered a perfectly family-friendly mum and dad show.
Yeah.
But, you know, Midsummer Rapists, perhaps not.
Yeah, isn't that funny how murder is something that often takes... We're still sometimes okay with it, aren't we? It's not always regarded as the most heinous crime.
It became a kind of drawing room murder mystery thing. It's like it's like Sudoku with a corpse. You know, it's there's not actually a sense that a human life has been snuffed out. And one of the great things about a show like Dexter is they draw you into his world and then every so often throw his serial killer status right back in your face and kind of ask you, oh, do you still like this person? Are you still watching?
Mm-hmm. I think that the premise of Dexter is pretty amazing, because I did hold off from seeing it for a long time purely for that reason of it was kind of like a moral question that I had for myself. Do I really want to sympathize with a serial killer? Because I know that this is going to be a good show and that the creators are going to be very successful in making me sympathize with that person. And do I really want to do that? Of course, I succumbed and I loved it. But it does pose those kind of questions that I think quite often, I mean, if you look at all the shows, I mean, look at the CSIs everywhere, where death is just so routine and mundane. In some ways, these kind of shows actually do reflect a little bit more about the importance of life.
Well, for people who don't know the premise, it's a serial killer who, as a child, his father recognised these instincts in him and basically said, well, if you have to kill people, make sure they're bad people. So it taps into almost a kind of comic book vigilante logic as well, where he has to choose victims who deserve it before then inflicting the normal serial killer kind of elaborate murders on them.
Terrible film, although when I shared the microphone with Byron, he really liked it. But we talked about Law Abiding Citizen, and that very much starts off in a similar thing, where he's killing the guys who really deserve to get killed, but then he crosses the line and starts taking on innocent people.
Yeah, it's very... And even the Saw films have a strange version of this too, where now it's like moral lessons via reverse bear trap, you know? Learn something about yourself or we will murder you horribly.
So this is Lovable Murderers. That's going to be on at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image on Thursday, 25th of March.
That's right.
Tickets are on sale. So it looks like you're also going to be talking about 24, Torturing is Fun, and Tony Soprano, of course, from Sopranos, a show which really does remind you that these are bad, bad men.
And I know you had the same difficulty in Where the Wild Things Are as I did, where it was disconcerting to hear Tony Soprano's voice coming out of the lovable monster.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, I'm going to put the links to Lovable Murderers also up on the Casting Couch Facebook page. Now, Martin, we can also find out all sorts of things about your other activities all over the place in the globe at www.martin, spelled with a Y, pedler.com. I'm going to put that on the Casting Couch Facebook page as well.
Excellent. Don't blame me for the Y. My parents were feeling creative. I didn't add it after an afternoon of listening to The Cure or something.
What about the silent Z? That's taking a little bit too far.
That was all me.
All the random umlauts over the A and the E. Yeah. Martin, thank you so much for coming onto the Casting Couch.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Good stuff, people. Get your tickets now to these events because they are selling extremely quickly. we hope to see you again.
Of course.
All right, some more music. We're going to finish up the Scorsese tribute now with two pieces of music from my two favourite Scorsese films. We're going to start off with some of Philip Glass's music from Kundun and then some of the Bernard Herrmann music from Taxi Driver. You're on a casting couch. This is Joy 94.9. Oh, those last chords crashing, sending shivers down my spine.
It's a very dramatic end to the show. It is.
Bernard Herrmann's score for Taxi Driver there. That's the legendary Bernard Herrmann who did a lot of music for Hitchcock. His last gig was Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. That's the end of my Scorsese music tribute.
You know what?
Got it out of my system.
I have really enjoyed it.
Ah, thank you.
I have been pleasantly surprised. I really loved it.
Well, cheers. I did have a great time putting it together. What a show. We're at the end. Thank you to Helen for looking after the news for us today. It's always a pleasure when she does that. A massive thank you to Maureen, who was our guest panellist and, of course, also reviewed a Hurt Locker for us. I think Maureen is the only person who's done every single job now on this show.
She's multi-talented.
Yeah, thank you, Maureen. Big thank you to Byron, one of our regular segment presenters who came in and gave that really lovely review of Jeffrey. Big thank you to Alan, our producer, who did put this together behind the scenes. Nick, who's our podcaster, that should go up around Tuesday or Wednesday. A big thank you to Warren, who looked after the desk. And our guest for the second hour was one Martin Pedler. And we rather liked him, didn't we, Kylie?
You know what? I could almost turn. He's so witty and he knows so much about films. Oh, I hope my girlfriend's not listening. Ignore that, Rose.
He was fantastic. And if you want to see him and three other equally wonderful people talk about zombies in popular culture, you want to head down to the Australian Centre for the Moving Image on Thursday, 25th of Feb at 7 p.m. Check out acme.net.au for more information about that. Now, the giveaway for A Single Man, we have two winners. They're going to go along to see the special advanced screening that Joy are doing with Cinema Nova tomorrow night at
6:30 p.m.
6:30, thank you. Ben from Melbourne City, congratulations. And Colin from Docklands, congratulations to you as well.
You're going to have a great time.
Both of you, you can bring a friend each, and it's a really extraordinary film and one that should be experienced on the big screen. Kylie, we're done.
Oh, another week bites the dust.
Thank you very much. It was lovely sharing the microphone with you again. People, keep on listening to Joy 94.9 because your evening is just going to start with Dennis and Dick presenting A Touch of Pink. So it's time to take off the black skivvies and black glasses that you wear when, you know, being serious
reviewing
about
films.
Film. Yeah, yeah. And just get your dancing clothes on because it's time to boogie.
You really need to stay in the cinema.
I really do. I tried, didn't I?
You gave it a great shot. But
I probably should have prepared something there, not
improvised.
You know what
was wrong? You didn't have your beret on, darling.
All right. Maureen's telling us to wrap up. Good night, everybody. This is Joy 94.9.
Good morning, Mr. Phelps. This is your mission, should you choose to accept it. Should you or any member of your IM force be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow all knowledge of your actions.
The Casting Couch, Joy 94.9's premier movie show.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.